Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. The budget deficit is out for the month. Budget deficit, this from today's Wall Street Journal. Budget deficit widens to $49.29 billion. Paced by record monthly spending and revenues, the federal government ran a deficit of $49.29 billion in October, up 4.3% from a year earlier, according to the Treasury Department. This, lest you think this is no big deal. I mean, this is huge. We're talking serious money here. I mean, we're talking really serious money here. And it's a reflection of a whole series of much larger issues that have to do with what the cost of the war is, what the cost of the Bush tax cuts is, income disparity in the United States. I mean, just to put this number in context, just to put it in a frame that makes sense. This is a $49.29 billion contribution this month to a total debt of $8,604,252,815,500.67. That's the national debt right now, which means that your share is $28,661.73. That's of the national debt. That doesn't include all the money that you are going to have to pay in interest. That means that if you're the breadwinner for a family of, say, four, say you have the standard 2.1 kids, your share of the national debt, $114,646. That's how much you are in debt as the breadwinner for a family of four. And make no bones about it, that money will have to be paid. This is the consequence, this $8.6 trillion debt that just went up by another $49.29 billion. This is the consequence of insane, what Bush Sr., George Herbert Walker Bush, referred to as voodoo economics, insane conservative economic policies. There is no other word to describe it than insane. There is a method to their madness. You see, they actually are trying to destroy American government because these guys don't believe in government. They don't believe in democracy. They're trying to shrink government down to the size where they can drown it in a bathtub because they think that government doing anything other than defending us in the military is socialism. And so the plan, and David Stockman, laid this thing out when he left the Reagan administration. He just laid it out. The plan is, you run the government, you run the country so direly, so badly, so deeply in debt. Now, back when Reagan was president, that meant let's take us from a $1 trillion debt to a $2 trillion debt. They figured that would be enough to cause the entire nation to freak out, for the economic community to go, hey, whoa, wait a minute, for the banking community and the investment community to start getting really nervous, for the Democrats to get really, for everybody to get really nervous. And at that point, people would say, okay, $2 trillion debt, we can't do that. We can't really raise the debt ceiling that much. You know, what we're going to have to do is we're going to have to start cutting social spending. We're going to have to do away with Social Security. We're going to have to do away with Medicare. We're going to have to do away with welfare. We're going to have to do away with our public school system and replace it with privatized schools and vouchers. We're going to have to do away with the Department of Environmental Protection, the Environmental Protection Agency. We're going to have to do away with the Food and Drug Administration. Just privatize this stuff. Let the pharmaceutical industry run the pharmaceuticals. Let the meatpacking plants decide whether or not our meat is safe. Let the agricultural industry decide, whether foods are safe. Let them tell us what's in their products or not. Let them choose whether or not how they're going to label things. You know, let's just do away with all these regulatory agencies. All they're doing is raising costs anyway. That's their philosophy. And they believed during the Reagan time. They came up with this harebrained scheme in 1981 that if they could run, if they could create a train wreck, if they could run this country so far into debt that it was irrefutable that the debt was a clear and present danger, a looming threat to the country. And there was no way, because the debt was so large, that you could immediately raise taxes and start paying it off. Because the tax raise would have to be so huge. Then the only alternative would be for Democrats, Republicans to get together and say, okay, that's it. It's the end of American government as we know it. We're going to go back to American government the way it was in 1890 during the era of the robber barons. No more Securities and Exchange Commission. No more federal oversight of corporate activity. No more FCC. Well, there wasn't an FCC in 1880, but you get the point. That's what they're all about. That is the conservative agenda. And, you know, during the 1980s, they were actually quite honest about it, quite upfront about it. In 1978, when George W. Bush ran unsuccessfully for Congress from Texas, he ran on a platform of privatizing Social Security. The government should not be in the business of making sure that there's a social safety net, he said over and over again. And he lost. So they started this campaign. The Reagan administration started this campaign. David Stockman called it starving the beast. This was the phrase that everybody inside the Reagan administration used. Let's starve the beast of starving the government of tax revenues. But the government would keep on spending. Because after all, you don't want to have a recession. So they put us on a credit card, and people now, they look back and you hear these righties, you know, on the talk radio. They, well, the economy was pretty good during Reagan. Well, first of all, they forget that there was a major recession when Reagan was president. But even if the economy was good when Reagan was president, you give me a $2 trillion credit card, I can show you what it looks like to live large. So in his 8 years, Ronald Reagan ran up more debt in this country when we were not in a war than every president before him combined. You take all the debt that Franklin Roosevelt ran up to pay for World War II. You take all the debt that Woodrow Wilson ran up to pay for World War I. You take all the debt that Harry Truman ran up to pay for the Korean conflict. You take all the debt that Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon ran up to pay for the Vietnam War. You take all the debt that McKinley ran up to pay for the Spanish-American War. You take all the debt that Abraham Lincoln ran up to pay for the Civil War. You take the debt, and literally all of these wars were paid for with debt. You take all the debt that was run up to pay for the War of 1812. The War of 1812, the one that the conservatives all forget about, all these right-wing commentators on TV, they all forget about when the United States was actually attacked on our soil. They say, we've never before been attacked on our soil. Say, what? Oh, 9/11, it changed everything. This is a different time in America because we actually got attacked on our soil. I'm sorry, in the War of 1812, the British occupied Washington, D.C. and burned down the White House. But the cons would like you to forget about history. They don't want you to know that James Madison, who was president when that happened, did not say, oh, gee, the Redcoats are here and they just burned down the White House. We need to suspend habeas corpus. We need to do away with the right of free speech. We need to eliminate the ability of people to have a trial. I mean, we have this weird confluence right now, and I realize I'm digressing slightly, but we have this weird confluence of today, the White House coming out and saying, terrorists have no rights. The Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, sorry, that's been replaced by the new Fifth Amendment right to be tortured. Now the government has the right to rip the words out of you. You no longer have the right to remain silent. They have the right to drown you until you're screaming the words. Your Sixth Amendment right to a speedy trial, forget that. And a trial by jury, your Seventh Amendment rights, your Eighth Amendment rights to a trial by jury, to be able to make bail against cruel and unusual. Forget all that stuff. It's all gone. And at the same time, they're saying, oh, and by the way, if you cause more than $10,000 worth of damage to, and this is just for terrorists, see, if you cause more than $10,000 worth of damage to animal labs or a factory farm, you're now a terrorist. But anyway, this starve the beast thing. Individual income tax receipts totaled $86.22 billion in October. Corporate tax receipts, and this is what came in, totaled $9 billion last month. Now, what's wrong with that picture? We, the people, paid $86 billion toward the cost of government in the month of October. Corporate America paid $9 billion toward the cost of government. If you go back, I mean, you go back 50 years, it was closer to 50-50. Corporations used to pay a good chunk of the cost of business, of government. After all, they use government. They use the educated workforce that we generate with our schools. They use the infrastructure and the right of way. They're the largest users of our court systems to enforce contracts. They use our police departments to protect their assets. They use our military to defend their business interests. And yet we paid $86 billion. They paid only $9 billion. And then we get into the distribution of wealth. We'll talk about that right at the break. 16 minutes past the hour.
Well, I was in the car and I heard this guy. He sounded all shook up and he told me why. His voice was a shaking on the EIB. Sounded like an Oxycontin eater to me. It was a bug-eyed, tone-deaf, flying Oxycontin eater.
Right-wing syndicated, spinning liberal people beater.
Right-wing, strung-out, hypocrite, prescription cheater. Rush looked strange to me. Well, his housekeeper picked up some drugs on the street, and she brought the stuff home for the boss to eat. I heard him say in a voice so gruff,
I tried to quit twice, but it was just too tough.
He was a big mouth, blowhard, right-wing propaganda.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program. Yes, fair and slightly unbalanced. The budget deficit today widens to $49.29 billion. That's how much we went in the hole in the month of October. You and I paid $86 billion toward the cost of running government. Corporations in America paid $9 billion. Now, if the corporations had paid the same as we paid, if we had both paid $86 billion, you would have right now a massive budget surplus, and we would be paying down the debt of the United States. But, oh, no. That's not what the cons want to have happen. In fact, think of what you paid in taxes last year. Federal taxes, federal income tax. Last year, the interest payment on this $8,604,254,090,000, you notice it's gone up since the last time I gave it to you. Back there, it just went up another $1 million. Another $2 million. $8,604,255,000,000, etc. The interest on that debt for fiscal year 2003, that was 2 years ago, was $318,148,529,151.51. So the interest on the debt for the fiscal year 2003 budget, your share of that per U.S. citizen, and this includes babies, this includes elderly people in nursing homes, people who are not paying income taxes, but the per-person share, $1,059.79. Last year, the fiscal year 2004, the last year that we have the figures for, that the government publishes the figures, total interest on the debt, the interest on the debt that Ronald Reagan, that was run up almost exclusively, or let's say largely, by Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush as part of this plan to destroy government, to shrink it down to the size where you can drown it in the bathtub by running it into a train wreck, right? The interest payment for the wage earner of a family of four on the last year that we have, fiscal year 2004, was $4,284.69. Your share, if you're the head of household for a family of four, $4,284.69. Now, that's just the interest payment. If we had no national debt, if you're the head of the family of four, you could have paid $4,200 less in taxes last year. This is incredible. We're looking at a debt this time, this year, that's going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of $250, $270, maybe $300 billion. And that doesn't include the $150 billion, which is called off budget for the cost of Iraq. You add that up together, and this year, just this year, George Bush is borrowing about $1 billion a day, mostly from China and Japan, which adds up to about $350 billion. Now, let's turn that into real numbers, into real money. What could $350 billion buy? It could pay for 45 million children to attend a year of Head Start. $350 billion, actually the number I'm using is $342 billion, because that's what the war in Iraq has cost so far, by odd coincidence. And there's this site called costofwar.com where you can just pull these numbers off. This $342 billion that we are borrowing this year, and that by coincidence is the amount that we've spent over the last 3 years in Iraq, could have insured for a full year, full health insurance, medical, dental, eyes, and everything, 204,941 children. I don't think there's that many children in the United States. I mean, it's incredible. 204 million children. We could have paid for the health insurance for 204 million people for a full year with the money that was borrowed this year by George W. Bush. With just the money that was borrowed this year by George W. Bush, we could have hired 5,931,280 public school teachers for a full year. You want to see America get competitive? It's also the amount of money that we've spent in Iraq. If we hadn't spent that money on in Iraq, this is what we could have done with it. Well, you say the real investment is in college. That's, you know, we're the brain drain. We've got to import people from all over the world because we don't have enough smart people in America. We don't have enough well-educated people in America. I guess it's the well-educated part that they say, not so much smart. Well, we could have paid, with that $342 billion, we could have provided full four-year scholarships at public universities for 16,591,662 people. And corporations last month paid $9 billion of the tax share. You and I paid $86 billion. What is wrong with this picture? 27 minutes past the hour. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Listener-supported radio, supported by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors like Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time, all fair trade, all organic. 1-800-425-2532, sacredgroundscoffee.com, their website. And if you put in fall in the coupon box when you check out, you'll get an additional 15% discount, fall as in the season. Small Dog Electronics. Get the latest iPods now. 1-800-511-MAX. Smalldog.com. 1-800-511-MACS. And the Organic Wine Company. 1-888-ECO-WINE or EcoWine.com. One of the folks in the chat room notes that, in fact, I'm looking for who it was here. I've lost it. Ultrax, I think it was. Sent a note. By the way, Tom, The debt, the interest on the national debt now the numbers I was giving you a few minutes ago were fiscal year 2002, 2003, 2004. It was $318 billion in 2003, fiscal year 2003. The amount of tax dollars that had to be raised to pay the interest on our national debt, it was $321 billion in 2004. It's now $405 billion for fiscal year 2006. We go into fiscal year 2007 went into it on November 1st. Now, there is a secondary side effect to this. I'm just going to lay this out, and then we'll get to your phone calls. Our number 866-440-8466, by the way, and tomhartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. There's a secondary side effect to all of this, and that is that the way that the cons have run up our debt is by and large not by increasing spending. Spending has actually, relatively speaking, been, let's say, I don't want to say steady because it's been increasing, but it hasn't been increasing as a percentage of the size of government or the size of the economy. It hasn't really been increasing all that much. They did it by driving down taxes. We had a top marginal tax rate in the United States from the 1930s up until 1964 of 90%. Now, that didn't mean that people like you and me paid 90%. What it meant that was that somebody like Limbaugh, who's making millions, well, bad example, because that's all going to OxyContin. Cheap shot. No, it's not anymore. That the billionaires who own Walmart, for example, the majority of the stock in Walmart, the Walton family, that on their first $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 of taxes, in today's dollars, they would pay an interest tax rate of 20, 30% after they start making $150,000, $170,000, they start paying 40, 50%. After they start making $200,000, $300,000 in today's dollars, if you were to go back to the 1950s, then they start paying 60, 70%. It slowly works up to the point where when you're making $1 billion a year or $1 million, a couple million dollars a year, you're paying 90%. At that point, it's like, why pay anybody more than $1 million a year? And so, gee whiz, from that period, from 1932 until 1980, when we had that top marginal tax rate of 90%, name one billionaire who emerged during that time. You can't. I mean, you know, there may be one or two. Sam Walton, maybe. I'm not sure. But it wasn't like the robber baron era where you could tick them off on your fingers. John Rockefeller, Jay Gould, J.P. Morgan, the Samuel Huntington, U.S. Steel, Andrew Carnegie, and the period before the taxes went up, the Joe Kennedy, or Prescott Bush, or the period after the taxes went down, after Reagan became president, and now we've got Bill Frist's daddy becoming a billionaire. I mean, they're just all over the place. These dynastic wealth. But what happened during that period from the 1930s to the 1980s when we had that high top marginal tax rate was, while we didn't get as many billionaires, we had the strongest middle class this country has ever seen. There is a real significant difference in the distribution of wealth. If you consider a football field, just imagine a football field for a minute. This is from, by the way, a website called lcurve.org. Consider a football field. The U.S. population is the football field. Okay, we're all standing on a football field. The median U.S. family income, this is the family standing at the 50-yard line. Half of America is richer than them. Half of America is poorer than them. People standing at the 50-yard line, they have an income of $40,000 a year. That's a stack of $100 bills 1.6 inches high. So they're standing at the 50-yard line, and right next to their feet, right next to their, standing right by them, is a stack of $100 bills. It's 1.6 inches high. Now we walk from the 50-yard line past the 60, 70, 80, 90, out to the 95-yard line, where we find the 95th percentile. We find people, they earn $100,000 a year. They have a stack of $100 bills about 4 inches high. Now we go out to the 99-yard line. At the 99-yard line, people are making $300,000 a year. That's a stack of $100 bills about a foot high. So it's still just, it's not up to their knees yet, their stack of $100 bills. At the 99-yard line, 1 foot from the goal line, so we're now the top 0.1%. The curve reaches around 1 million. That's a 40-inch high stack of $100 bills. 40 inches is still up to your waist. When you stand at the goal line, or, say a centimeter from the goal line, the top income earners in the United States, that stack of $100 bills becomes 30 miles high. 30 miles high. Keep in mind, the family at the 50-yard line, their stack of $100 bills is 1.6 inches high. The family at the 95-yard line, their stack of $100 bills at $100,000 a year income is 4 inches high. At the 99-yard line, their stack of $100 bills is a foot high. 1 foot from the goal line, the stack of $100 bills is only up to their waist. When you get to the goal line, that smallest fragment of the wealthiest of Americans, Their stack of $100 bills is 50 kilometers or 30 miles high. And George W. Bush suggested that the tax cut to that group should be $500,000 for every job that we hope that they will create by building a factory someplace. $500,000 for every job. $500,000. And he said they should be, if they earn their income by passive means, by having invested wealth, they should pay a maximum of 15% income tax rather than like you and me who work having to pay 30, 31, 32, whatever it may be, you know, the top rate. But here's George W. Bush.
With a robust package of at least $550 billion and across-the-board tax relief, we will help create more than 1 million new jobs.
1 million divided into $550 billion is $550,000 per job. That's what we paid. And sure enough, we gave those folks standing at the goal line with the 30-mile-high stack of $100 bills, we gave them that $550 billion tax cut, and they did create 1 million jobs. In China! 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Steven in Atlanta. Hey, Steven.
Hi, Tom. I'm sitting here looking at a graph called, it's got the yearly U.S. budget deficit or surplus from 1961 till now.
Right.
And it's put out by the Congressional Budget Office. And there are two spikes that I'd like you to maybe give your input or insight on, where it shot up during Reagan was one and during George W. Bush.
Right.
Reagan's it shot up from, looks like, $220 billion in debt from the middle of 1986 to the middle of 1987. It shot up about $70 billion in 1 year.
Right.
So in effect, we were, as a country under him, paying down the debt during that year. And then it continued to go kind of stagnate, and then we went on to Bush 41. Now, during W, looks like between middle of 04 and middle of 05, it shot up similarly from $413 billion to just $318 billion. What do you account, what do you say about that?
Yeah. When you look at a 1 year change over a long trend,
right.
It could be anything, Stephen. And frankly, I'd have to go back and look at those individual years to be able to tell you. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. But the bottom line is that you look at the trend line and you see the debt is exploding. And the debt is exploding because these guys think that's a good thing, because they think if they can run this country into bankruptcy, then we will have to do away with our social programs and we'll no longer have what they call socialism in America. Fred in Springfield, Oregon. Hey, Fred, we got to take a break here in about a half a minute. What's up?
Okay, I just wanted to say, based on what you were talking this morning, all I can say is I've been thinking the same thing for a long time, at least the last 5 years, and I've come to the conclusion that what we have in this office today are aptly called anarchists. I know that
yeah.
The real definition of anarchists is you're bringing down the government from without, but always the cleverest idea would be to join them and do it from within. And this is what these guys are doing. They have circumvented every part of the government by denying them their budgets, so effectively killing them. They've diverted all that money to their favorite little war over in Iraq, and
yeah.
They've given it to all these no-bid contract people.
And the Carlyle Group is making out like bandits, and their lawyer, Jim Baker, and their former CEO, George Herbert Walker Bush. Yeah, absolutely, Fred. Well said. They are anarchists, and we've got to stop them before they bring anarchy to America. 45 minutes past the hour.
A congressman from Florida sent notes to a page. Things soon got much horrider, because the page was underage. And we're singing, hang down your head, Mark Foley, hang down your head and cry. You once appeared so holy, now the right has a big black eye.
And welcome back. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you, coming up on 9 minutes before the hour. This last month, the month of October, the numbers are in. The U.S. budget deficit up we ran up a debt for the month of $49.29 billion. That's more than $1 billion a day. It's up 4.3% from a year earlier. Now, the total spending for the month was $216 billion. Total receipts $167 billion. Okay? We get this? So we spent $216 billion in the month of October. We brought in $167 billion. Of that $167 billion that we brought in, $86 billion of it came from you and me. $9 billion came from corporate income taxes. We paid an interest on the federal debt of $18.95 billion. What is wrong with this picture? Why are there not headlines running, corporations pay $9 billion, individuals pay $86 billion in the month of October to run the government? Why is that not a screaming headline across America? Richard in Canton, Ohio. Hey, Richard, welcome to the program.
Hi. Just wanted to disagree with you on one thing about, I travel a lot in Canada as a truck driver, and the Canadians take great pride in the fact that they were the ones who burnt down the White House in 1812.
When I digressed from my rant earlier, when I talked about how the Bushies say the 9/11 was the first time we've been attacked on American soil, you know, forgetting apparently about Pearl Harbor and obviously forgetting about the War of 1812. That's interesting. So the Canadians claim credit for that. Well, but Canada was a British territory at that time, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, but I mean, the Canadians take big pride in the fact that they were the ones who burned down the White House. And I was up there right after 9/11, and they said, "You shouldn't feel too bad about that one. We got the White House 9/11, and just like you said, we won the war and kicked them out, and that was all it took, you know." So.
Yeah.
I gotta bring that up. By the way, I've been calling for a long time, and I wanted to give you condolences on your great father. He must have been a great man to raise a great man like you.
Well, thank you. My father was a really, truly decent human being and a lifelong Republican, so I, what can I say?
I wanted to relate that to my father. He was a Republican until he went, through the end of Eisenhower's, years. We went to see him speak, and my dad got to shake his hand. And it was after Eisenhower made his speech about, watch out for the industrial complex. My dad said, "I was always a lifelong Republican, and based on your speech, I'm going Democratic." And Eisenhower told him, "Good."
Yeah. So, well, see, Eisenhower in 1952 almost ran as a Democrat. Nobody was sure which way he was going to go. And in fact, I have a couple of Eisenhower clips that we're going to play in the next hour that I want to share with folks. So, Richard, thanks a lot. Good to hear from you. Bob in Lake Stevens, Washington. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I wanted to talk about the way the income tax structure, the deficit spending is what I wanted to talk about, the way it redistributes income from the lower income brackets up to the upper income.
That right, because people like the Bush family, a lot of their money is invested in government bonds. So that interest that we're paying to, like George W. Bush, born with a multi-million dollar trust fund in treasury notes, all that interest is being paid by you and me in our income taxes, and he gets the income from it.
That's just it. We're paying interest to the people who we should be taxing.
Yeah. Yeah, well said. Thank you, Bob. Mark in Eureka, California. Hey, Mark, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Yeah, I was just wondering where you get this information on the tax proportions there for October.
This is from today's Wall Street Journal. I think it's page 3. Let's see. No, it's page 1, must be, because I cut it out. I've got this little square in my hand, so I don't know which page number. But it's in the
What's
first couple.
The source? Do they cite a source, though?
Just Dateline Washington. Here, I'll read you the article straight up. This is from the Wall Street Journal. Paced by record monthly spending and revenues, the federal government ran a deficit of $49.29 billion in October, up 4.3% from a year earlier, the Treasury Department said. The Treasury's monthly budget statement shows outlays were $216.98 billion last month, up 10% from a year earlier. Government receipts in October were $167.69 billion, up 12% from a year earlier. Both receipts and outlays were records for the month of October, the Treasury said, while noting the government has run a deficit every October since 1954. And then they go on. Individual tax receipts totaled $86.22 billion in October, up 15% from the same period last year. Corporate income taxes totaled $9.35 billion last month, up 53% from the same period in 2005. The government paid net interest in October on the federal debt of $18.95 billion.
That article is the reason why I, as a conservative, see this last election as a tremendous win for the people of this country, because I've always believed that the consolidation of wealth through mergers and acquisitions and the corresponding political power is the greatest threat to me as a sovereign individual and this country as a sovereign nation.
I agree with you, but Mark, that is the conservative position, that the consolidation of wealth is a good thing. It's been the conservative position from Alexander Hamilton till today.
But the base don't believe that because they have an ownership. See, that's a deep sense of ownership, and I'm coming from the Midwest, and I'm telling you that they have no support whatsoever in the conservative base anywhere in this country for this position of divesting our country.
Yeah.
And there's not a chance. And I'll just say this, that
sure.
When they say globalization is in control, ask them, who is globalization and how do they take over our economy and how do they change our constitution?
Right. Well, this is what George Herbert Walker Bush talked about, the New World Order. You know,
there are names and faces behind the word globalization, names
yeah.
and entities, and
absolutely.
They are not in control. It's we the people, and we can
well,
enforce the law.
It should be. I agree, Mark. I agree. It should be. And 52 out of the top, the largest 100 economies in the world right now are multinational corporations. So, you know, there it is. It's time for us in the United States to bring back the Sherman Antitrust Act and start enforcing the law that's still on the books that Ronald Reagan stopped enforcing in 81. 57 minutes past the hour. I'll be right back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
So consider where we're at. Now, the Bush administration, following on from Reagan, I mean, this strategy that David Stockman called Star of the Beast, that the Reagan administration hatched this scheme, let's run the country into such debt that the Democrats will be forced to stop cherishing programs like Medicare. Now, Department of Education, we shouldn't have that. After all, education can be taken care of by Chris Whittle and his corporate schools. Welcome back, by the way. Tom Hartman here, the second hour of our program today. So you've got that. And on top of this, on top of trying to destroy the United States government by reducing taxes on the most wealthy and reducing taxes on corporations and raising taxes on all the rest of us, you'll recall Ronald Reagan actually signed into law the largest tax increase on working people in the history of the United States, bar none. He doubled the tax on the Social Security tax. He doubled FICA. It was the largest tax increase on working people in the history of the United States. He also signed into law the biggest cut in taxes on wealthy people in the history of the United States, fundamentally changing the structure of our society. And as a consequence, over the last 26 years, what we have seen is that literally the rich have gotten richer and the poor have gotten poorer, and the middle class is vanishing. And in the midst of this, as at home, we're becoming poorer. We look around the world, and the world is looking at us with horror, not just for our economic insanity, but for our international insanity. For our sacrificing, for our setting aside the fundamentals on which this country was founded. We mentioned in the first hour the War of 1812. In 1812, the British, or the Canadians, from our caller, invaded the United States and seized and burned the White House. Dolly Madison, the wife of James Madison, had left 2 days earlier. She had to leave the White House in the middle of the night. The only thing she was able to rescue was a painting of George Washington, cut it out of the frame and rolled it up and brought it with her. And that was it. And they took the White House and they set the thing on fire. And James Madison, the president of the United States at that time, who was then fighting the British in the War of 1812, did he say, okay, that's it. Now we are going to do away with the First Amendment to the Constitution. No more right of free speech. From now on, if you're going to speak out against me, you have to go to a free speech zone. No, he didn't. He said America is a free speech zone. Did James Madison say, no more Fifth Amendment? No person shall be held for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless upon presentation or indictment of a grand jury. The Fifth Amendment. No person shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself. No person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. This is the Fifth Amendment to the United States. Did James Madison say, okay, we can set that aside. We can deprive people of life, liberty, and property without due process of law? Because after all, they're terrorists and they burned down the White House. No, James Madison didn't say that. Although they did burn down the White House and they were terrorizing Americans. Did he say, let's set aside the Sixth Amendment? The Sixth Amendment, which says in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury. They shall have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in their favor. Shall be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation, confronted with witnesses against him, and to have the assistance of a lawyer of counsel for defense. This is the Sixth Amendment. Did James Madison say, we need to set that aside? No. He said, we are fighting for the Sixth Amendment. Did he say, we need to set aside the Seventh Amendment that says the right to trial by jury shall be preserved? Did he say, we should set aside the Eighth Amendment, which says excess bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted? And say, no, we don't need the Eighth Amendment anymore. Instead, we're going to go with cruel and unusual punishments. We're going to start drowning people to get them to tell us what they've done, because we've already set aside their Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. Did he say that? No. Why? Because he was a patriot. Because he was an American. Because he loved this nation. And now we've got these Republicans, the chorus, the choir. This story today from the Associated Press. Immigrants arrested in the United States. Now get that. Arrested in the United States. Not arrested in Afghanistan. Not arrested in Iraq. Not arrested in Kazakhstan. Arrested in the United States. May be held indefinitely. That is forever. On suspicion of terrorism and may not challenge their imprisonment in civil courts, the Bush administration said Monday, opening a new legal front in the fight over the rights of detainees. In court documents filed with the 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Richmond, Virginia, the Justice Department, Alberto Gonzalez, the Justice Department said a new anti-terrorism law being used to hold detainees in Guantanamo Bay also applies to foreigners captured and held in the United States. They're talking about a guy from Qatar who was living in the United States and going to school here in 2001. He was arrested and labeled an enemy combatant. And they said, because you're an enemy combatant, he's like, oh, wait a minute, I'm just a student here at Columbia University. No, sorry, you're an enemy combatant. You can't see a lawyer. You can't talk to your family. You have no right to a trial. You're going to sit here and rot until you die. That is the argument that the United States government, our government, on behalf of us, is making before the U.S. Supreme Court. Excuse me, before the 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. And the world is looking at us going, what has happened? These people have lost their minds. You know, there was a time when Republicans got it. In 1964, at the Republican convention that nominated Barry Goldwater, the former Republican president of the United States from 1952 until 1960, Dwight Eisenhower, stood up and gave a speech which was loudly applauded. He got a standing ovation for it. This is what Dwight Eisenhower had to say.
There is only one real peace now, and that is peace for all time.
The only peace for all time. Well, how do we get that?
Today, we are competing for men's hearts and minds and trust all over the world.
Wait a minute. We're competing for their trust? I thought we wanted them to fear us.
In such a competition, what we are at home and what we do at home is even more important than what we say abroad.
Oh, wait a minute. According to the Bush playbook here, what we do at home is we can throw out the Constitution, we can throw out the Bill of Rights, and then we can go bomb some other country and tell them we're doing it for democracy. Mr. Eisenhower, you must be an idealist here.
Here again, my friends, we find constructive work for each of us. What each of us does, how each of us acts, has an influence on this question.
How each of us acts? How each of us, including the president, how our nation behaves could actually have an influence on the world, that we could actually bring about world peace by being peaceful ourselves. We could bring about decency in the world by being decent ourselves. Is that what you're saying, President Eisenhower?
There can be no enduring peace for any nation while other nations suffer privation, oppression, and a sense of injustice and despair. In our modern world, it is madness to suppose that there could be an island of tranquility and prosperity in the sea of wretchedness and frustration.
And for that, the Republican president of the United States, standing beside Barry Goldwater, got a standing ovation as the Republicans of the United States got it. And the Democrats were by and large in the same place, I might add, with regard to these kinds of issues. Yes, we are Americans. This is America. We stand for something. You'll find it in the Declaration of Independence, in the Constitution, in the Federalist Papers. You will find it written throughout the fabric of our country and in the history of this country. We stand for something. We stand for the liberal ideals on which this country was founded. George Washington, the first president to call himself a liberal and say that he hoped that America would ever be at the forefront of liberality. The liberal ideals of the Enlightenment, of human rights, of human dignity. 16 minutes past the hour.
I got news of the very best kind about troubles that have fallen behind about people that used to be blind till they opened up their eyes to see. It's news when they begin to ask why they're poor until the day that they die they're tired. And it's news, news.
And welcome back, my friends. The place for being progressive never felt so good, where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Fiendishly plot for clean elections. How's that? We'll go for that. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And time now to check in on what's going on with the U.S. occupation. No, it's not a war. It's an occupation. The occupation of Iraq.
I want to know the men in the shadows of. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lights in the balance.
Security developments in Iraq as of 1600 hours Greenwich Mean Time on Tuesday, today. Dateline Baghdad, this is from Reuters. Dateline Baghdad, a car bomb in Sadr City, a Shiite district in eastern Baghdad, killed two people and wounded 21. In Diyala, residents in Diyala province said a U.S. airstrike killed six members of a family in the village of Zor Albu Hishma. The U.S. military said it would look into the report. You know, somehow, let me interject an editorial comment into this. Somehow we have forgotten that there are human beings on the other end of these bullets and these bombs. And that not only are there human beings who have real lives and real feelings and really don't want to die, thank you very much, but there are also families for those human beings. And that when you occupy a country against the will of its citizens, which is what we're doing right now, The polls show that anywhere from 60 to 80% of all Iraqis think it is appropriate to shoot at Americans because we are illegally occupying their country. When you occupy a country against the will of its citizens, and then you start killing its citizens tend to react negatively. Look at the Boston Massacre, which arguably started the American Revolution. Here you had a couple of British soldiers standing there in the snow in Boston. And in fact, John Adams, who became the second president of the United States, actually defended the lieutenant who was in charge of these British officers in court, believing that even bad guys should have a lawyer. You had these British soldiers standing in the snow in Boston, and they were being taunted by a bunch of American patriots, we would call ourselves. The British called us terrorists. They were being hassled and taunted to the point where one of them felt that he was being, you know, stones were being thrown at them, snowballs were being thrown at them, bricks were being thrown at them, and so one of them shot an American. Actually, several gunshots were fired. And one American died. And the newspapers picked it up and spread it across the country as the Boston Massacre, and thus began the American Revolution. People have families. People have communities. Back to our report here. Diyala. Residents in Diyala province said a U.S. airstrike killed six members of a family in the village of Zor al-Buhishma. U.S. military said it would look into the report. In Ramadi, Iraqi medical officials said at least 30 people were killed in violence overnight in the Sunni insurgent stronghold of Ramadi in what local police described as a U.S. military raid. A U.S. military spokesman said she would look into the reports. Baghdad, gunmen wearing Iraqi police commando uniforms kidnapped as many as 100 men from a higher education ministry building in central Baghdad. Government spokesman later said there are at least 50 hostages. In Baqaba, Iraqi police backed by U.S. forces discovered the bodies of 10 kidnapped victims bound, blindfolded, and with gunshot wounds inside a house in Baqaba. In Baghdad, mortars killed 4 people and wounded 6 in Al-Zuhur. You think these people are going to... How long is it going to take them to forgive us for this? For invading their country when there was no damn reason to. In Baghdad, a bomb inside a bus station in eastern Baghdad killed 2 people and wounded 10. In Tikrit, a car bomb in downtown Tikrit, Saddam Hussein's hometown, wounded 10 people. In Baghdad, a car bomb ripped through a crowded market area and Rashid Street in central Baghdad, killing 10 people. In Baghdad, gunmen killed a security guard for former Prime Minister Ayad Alawi on his way home in the western Gaya Zaliya district. In Kirkuk, gunmen killed a man in the northern Iraqi city of Kirkuk. In Mosul, police found 11 bodies with gunshot wounds on Tuesday. In Baqaba, gunmen attacked a police patrol, killing 3 policemen. In Baghdad, a car bomb wounded 3 people in the northwestern Hiraya district. In Baghdad, Iraqi army killed 3 insurgents and arrested 72 suspected insurgents. In Baghdad, chanting slogans in support of a radical anti-American Shiite cleric, mourners carried coffins through a Baghdad district where Iraqi officials said U.S. forces killed 6 people overnight in a raid. The U.S. military declined to confirm the deaths. In Yushafia, U.S. forces conducted an airstrike on Monday in the town of Yushafia, claiming that they killed 3 insurgents, that we killed 3 insurgents.
You say we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
27 minutes past the hour.
A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. When they've tortured and scared you for 20-odd years, then they expect you to pick a career. When you can't really function, you're so full of fear. A working class hero is something to be.
Indeed. Welcome back. This is the place where despair is not an option. Get active, my friends. It's not about fear. No, it really isn't. It is about hope. It's about understanding where this country has been. It's about looking at where this country can go. It's about looking forward toward the future. It's about America. As FDR said,
let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance.
There you go. And it's time for us to advance. 35 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Lee in Duval, Washington. Hey, Lee, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hi, Tom. Hey, I hear your outrage, and I share it. I think too many people are sleepwalking through life right now, and they just can't afford to do that.
I hope I don't come across as outraged as much as concerned. There are some very real problems that we are facing, both fiscally and with regard to the future of liberties, civil liberties, you know, the nature of democracy in the United States. But rather than getting angry about it, what we need to do is we need to get active about it. We need to wake up our friends and neighbors. We all need to be Paul Revere.
What I called to talk about was James Baker of this Iraq study group.
A lot of what
we do in Iraq from this point forward is going to depend on this report. But James Baker, like a lot of the people in the 9/11 Commission, I think Lee Hamilton's on that, but James Baker in particular is so conflicted in this. I can't believe that the Democrats or people or even the news media are not at least pointing out his kind of sordid past.
Now James Baker has a political past with the Bush administration, certainly with the George W. Bush administration. He was the guy who in 2000 orchestrated the whole program to bring in John Roberts and have him train the lawyers how to argue before Judge Rehnquist, Chief Justice Rehnquist, to bring in John Bolton and have him lead a group of staffers from Tom DeLay's office banging on the windows where they were trying to count the vote in Florida. To basically shut down the vote. I mean, James Baker led that whole thing to steal the election of 2000.
And the Baker bought a law firm is defending the bin Laden family and the Saudis against the lawsuit of the 9/11. He's a member of the Carlyle Group, so is George Herbert Walker Bush. What the point is, I mean, and the list goes on.
Why don't you go through the list for a little bit here, Lee? I'll give you a minute on the air here or two.
Well, it says he's a member of the Carlyle Group. We have extensive ties to Enron, Global Crossing, Arthur Anderson. He has financial interest in the Caspian, the sent gas pipeline that was going to go through that they called for, and they had to have the Taliban removed. Now, that I don't know if you've ever read that letter from a presentation, John J. Maresca, Vice President of UNICAL in 1998, gave a presentation to a subcommittee of Congress and literally spoke about how important it was for the Taliban to be removed so they could get their gas line, their pipelines in there. So
right.
He was part of that, and
which
it just
is now
goes
being
on
built.
And on and on.
Yeah.
The conflict, and then there's Cheney with Halliburton. I mean, he was Secretary of State under the first Bush, and he approved of some huge contracts for Halliburton. Then he gets out of government, and he becomes the CEO of Halliburton.
Yeah, well,
then he gets
what's
back
most
to government, and he gives more contracts to Halliburton. It's crazy.
Well, what's most bizarre about that, Lee, is that when Cheney was in there as chief of staff in the Ford administration, and he hired Halliburton to do an analysis of how the government could outsource and privatize government functions. Halliburton did that analysis, and that analysis is what has been used to hire Halliburton under the George W. Bush administration.
Yeah. I was a reporter in Prince George for several years, and one time I went to a hockey wrap-up banquet dinner, and during that time, it was pretty light affair stuff. They gave me a coffee cup, and I took the coffee cup back to my office and put it up on my desk, and one of the other reporters walked in, you know, a day later and says, "Where'd you get that?" And I told him, and he said, "You can't keep that." I says, "Why not?" He says, "Well, it's a conflict of interest." I said, "Bill, it's a coffee cup, and it's the Spruce Kings. It's a junior hockey team. What's the big deal?" And we had a discussion, and I come around to his way of thinking. I think if you are going to hold yourself as a professional, any semblance of conflict of interest cannot be tolerated. And what's going on in this administration is making billionaires and millionaires and costing people hundreds of thousands of lives. And people are not calling this conflict of interest. I don't understand. Please help me on this one.
Well, this is what I believe that the Democrats, now that they have the power of subpoena, will begin to uncover. You know, in previous administrations, both Republican and Democratic, in previous administrations, the party out of power was still allowed to hold hearings and to call witnesses, to subpoena witnesses. Since George W. Bush became president in 2000, Republicans have denied to Democrats the right to hold a hearing, to call a hearing, or to subpoena witnesses. It's absolutely un-American. And if I find it a little strange, although I salute her for it, that Nancy Pelosi is saying that when she becomes majority leader, when she becomes the Speaker of the House, she's actually going to roll back these rules that the Republicans put into place in 2001 and go back to doing it the way it used to be done so that the Republicans, even though they're not in power, can still subpoena witnesses and hold hearings. I find that incredible that she's willing to do that. But basically what she's saying is we're going to rule the way, the American tradition, the capital A American tradition, the way that Congress has been run for 230 years, not this, for lack of a better word, pseudo-fascist administration that's been running for the last 5 years, where I realize it's very strong language, and I don't mean it as Nazi. Hitler was not a fascist. He was a crazed madman mass murderer. But this is the fascists were Mussolini and Franco. This is the merging of corporate and state, the government becoming an instrument of multinational corporations and the lockdown of government itself so that it's no longer accountable to the people. And it's wrong. So Lee, go ahead.
Do I have time to ask you one little economic question?
Sure.
When we were doing a lot of land and resource management planning, a term was coming in from the economic side. It was called real cost of doing business.
Yeah.
And that was, say you put a mine in and, they guaranteed X number of dollars and so on and so forth. But when that mine pulled out, the community stuck with the cleanup costs. And they said they were going to start doing that. And I thought that really gave hope to, what corporations and stuff really cost communities. And,
yeah, it's also called accounting for externalities.
Yeah, what's happened to that? It's fallen out of favor again.
Yeah. Surprise, surprise. There's a great book. I actually, on my local program on KPOJ this morning, interviewed the author of it. He was here in the studio. He's doing a thing in Portland called Lives Per Gallon, The True Cost of Our Oil Addiction. And his name is Terry Tamminen. And he was the head of the EPA in California. And he wrote this book where he accounts for the real cost. What does it really cost us for a gallon of gasoline? And if you look at the cost of the military to defend our oil interests around the world, if you look at the cost of people who have died as a result of exposure to hydrocarbons, to the cancer-causing toxins in gasoline and oil and the exhaust from our cars, for example, he points out that we know now that children who live within 1 mile of a freeway lose 1% of their lung function every year of their lives. When you take in these costs, the costs of cleanup and waste, from refinery, from drilling, all of these things, when you take in all these, quote, external costs, and this is not including the cost of global warming, which is also an external cost, an externalized cost. When you take into consideration all these other externalized costs, where the costs are being paid by you and me as taxpayers, a gallon of gasoline actually costs right now a little over $10 a gallon. And he said, if we were actually paying for gasoline at the cost that it really represents to society, because we are paying $10 a gallon. We're just paying most of it through taxes that are used or through higher insurance rates that are used to treat people who are sick or to make up for the lost productivity of people or make up the lost lives, things like that. We're actually paying that right now. And he said at that price, all these alternative energies become wildly economically viable. Wildly. I mean, anything over $4 a gallon for gasoline, and you can effectively compete with it with existing technology for solar and wind and biomass. At $10 a gallon, it becomes so. What you're talking about is called accounting for externalities. The costs that are dumped on we the people. When Walmart comes into a community, the increased cost for healthcare, because now you've got people who used to have a job with healthcare, now they don't. They're getting healthcare from the community, from Medicare, from the emergency rooms in the hospitals. You and I pick up that bill, not Walmart. So they make more profit, we pay more taxes. They externalize their expenses and internalize their profits. Does it make sense, Lee?
Yes, it does. And you nailed it, Tom. Thank you so much. Keep on doing what you're doing, man.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks a lot for the call. And that's the bottom line. I mean, that is the game that is being played right now, and it's being played so elegantly by these cons of internalizing the profits, internalizing the wealth, and externalizing the costs. In other words, dumping the costs on we, the people, so that we're paying for these things with our tax dollars. And then you look at, like today in the Wall Street Journal, this report that last month, October, you and I paid $86 billion toward the cost of government. Corporate America paid $9 billion. What's wrong with that picture? 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back with your calls. 866-440-8466.
Demand is up, supplies are down. What I want is like crude and brown. I crave oil to get my kicks. Attacked Iraq to get my fix. I love oil, oh, every ounce.
Nuclear. The American Addicts song. Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. By the way, heads up, I'll be at the, for people listening on the 5 radio stations of Pacific Northwest that carry this program, I'll be on LiveWire at the Aladdin Theater in Portland about my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class. This is Thursday, November 16th, Thursday of this week at the Aladdin Theater on Milwaukee in Portland. Tickets are $10, advance $12 at the door. And I don't have a website for more information, but we'll get one soon. Ellen Ratner with Talk Radio News in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com on the line. Hey, Ellen.
Okay, well, you know, it's interesting. This morning there was a pen and pencil, as we call them, meaning no cameras, at the Steny Hoyer briefing. And, of course, the press was over him like a wet blanket about this issue with John Murtha. And if I may be totally off base here, but this is my read, that essentially Steny Hoyer has the votes. So he cut a deal with Nancy Pelosi to say she is going to support her buddy and friend, John Murtha, and knowing that he's not going to win, and then she's sort of figured out, you know, she's checked off her chit, and then she continues to work with Hoyer.
So she's paid back Murtha for helping her become the majority leader back a couple of years ago.
Exactly.
And, yeah, well, it makes sense. Ellen, in the beginning of the next hour, we're going to have on one of the folks from the Center for Constitutional Rights, your brother's organization.
My brother's in Germany as we speak.
Yes. So just by way of previewing this, people are going to get all the details in about 10 minutes, but tell us what Michael Ratner's up
to. My brother and the Center for Constitutional Rights are in Germany, which, of course, has different kind of laws than we do, and is suing Donald Rumsfeld essentially for war crimes. And so, I mean, that's sort of the long and short of it.
Right.
He's very surprised at the press this is getting. So I just talked to him yesterday when he was in Germany, because he was surprised that the traditional press is beginning actually to pick this up. You've seen National Public Radio, which, you know, I think is straight down the middle. I don't think it's liberal in any way, shape, or form, picking up the story.
No, in fact, I would argue that NPR is becoming very Republican these
days.
Well,
yeah, I mean, it's certainly in terms of their the kind of people they have on, they tend
right.
to have administration
their
people
choice of
on
guests.
As guests a lot yeah. more. But in any case, so this is very much something that they hope to get some international recognition for. And, of course, now, I mean, Rumsfeld resigned right at a time when this, of course, is going to get even more news.
Yeah, interesting. Okay.
So that's my bottom line on that one. Now, I had a little encounter yesterday with Mr. Snow. The White House put out a one sheet that said that there should not be any negotiations for drug prices by the Democratic Congress because they want to negotiate for Medicare, Medicaid. You know, the United States is the largest purchaser of drugs.
Right.
Well, he said, you know, let market prices determine that.
Right, which means competition and negotiation, which is the opposite of what he's saying.
Of course. But then the president's meeting, or met actually this morning, with the three large automakers, and somebody pointed out, well, the largest auto employers almost in this country are foreign automakers, and what's wrong with competition on that one? Tony did not have an answer.
Yeah, well, that's all the more the tragedy of it. Ellen, thanks so much for your report today.
You're very welcome.
What you're doing at talkradionews.com. Great talking with you. Ellen Ratner with Talk Radio News, talkradionews.com. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Jimmy in Sacramento, California. Hey, Jimmy, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Tom. I want to preface this by saying that I'm in ways a recovering libertarian.
Mm-hmm.
I've come to the conclusion that the regulation of economic freedoms is necessary, or else the abuse of them can cause the destruction of society.
That's the fundamental flaw with the libertarian philosophy, is that it doesn't account for community.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm trying to figure out why so few libertarians are not raising a big ruckus about the loss of the rights, like habeas corpus.
Well, you've got a few. I mean, Bill Maher is a libertarian. He's out there talking about this stuff.
Oh, because it seems that a lot of them are basically like soldier souls in order to get their economic program passed.
You know, Ron
minus
Paul.
Their political,
Ron Paul, the Republican congressman from Texas, is, to the best of my knowledge, the only real pure libertarian in the House of Representatives. And he's raising hell about the loss of habeas corpus.
All right.
So I think that there are some libertarians who are speaking up and speaking out. And a good thing it is. Jimmy, thanks a lot for the call. John in Los Angeles, California. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. In the first hour, towards the end there, you had mentioned about, you were talking about conservatives to another person and how basically they all believe in
the consolidation of wealth and power, yes.
Right, and there is one conservative that was different, and that was Teddy Roosevelt. If you remember, he was, in fact, you know, deemed the trust buster.
He was a Republican, but he was not a conservative. Teddy Roosevelt referred to himself as a progressive.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because I know there was, he tried after to do the Progressive Party.
That's
which,
right.
I think there should be one nowadays.
Yeah, for sure. Well, see, what we have to do, because we have a two-party system in the United States, and Teddy Roosevelt, you know, certainly highlighted this in what was the election 1912, as I recall, is that we should take back the Democratic Party. And for that matter, I'd love to see Republicans, real Republicans, take back the Republican Party, Dwight Eisenhower Republicans, and let's go back to rationality in American politics.
Sure.
But you're right that Teddy Roosevelt was a Republican who was against big business, but he was a progressive Republican. Teddy Roosevelt and Abraham Lincoln are the most famous progressive Republican presidents. And really, I would argue, the only two progressive Republican presidents. To a certain extent, Dwight Eisenhower, he was really more of a moderate liberal. But most of the rest of them are just right-wing cranks or tools of big business, and all the more the tragedy for the United States. But wouldn't it be nice if Republicans of goodwill were to take back their party? We're going to be talking with the Center for Constitutional Rights after the news, and then we'll be back with your phone calls and more right here on the Tom Hartman Program, 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. And radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, are the mighty going to be laid low? Our quote for the day from Thomas Jefferson: all too will bear in mind this sacred principle, that though the will of the majority is in all cases to prevail, that will, to be rightful, must be reasonable. That the minority must possess their equal rights, which equal laws must protect. And to violate would be oppression and tyranny. Welcome back to the program. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Vince Warren on the line with us. He's with the Center for Constitutional Rights, ccr-ny.org, their website. And as we mentioned in the last hour, talking to Ellen Ratner, her brother Michael is in Germany right now. Vince, welcome to the program. Hello, Vince.
Hello, Tom.
Hey, Vince.
How are you? It's great to be here.
Thank you. Tell us about this extraordinary move. Well, first of all, you guys tried this a year or two ago, didn't you, of prosecuting Rumsfeld for war crimes in Germany?
Yeah, we sure did. A couple of years ago, we filed a complaint with the German top prosecutor to open an investigation and ultimately a criminal prosecution that will look into the responsibility of high-ranking U.S. officials for authorizing war crimes in response to the so-called war on terror. That case was dismissed by the prosecutor, interestingly enough, under pressure from the U.S. government. It turns out that Donald Rumsfeld, who was a defendant in that lawsuit, in that complaint as well, was set to attend some sort of meeting in Germany and put pressure on the German prosecutor, refused to go to the meeting unless the case was dismissed. The prosecutor dismissed the case the day before the conference, and he went. Well, this time, we filed another complaint with the German prosecutor. It turns out that the German prosecutor is different because the last prosecutor had roughly 50 complaints under this universal jurisdiction statute, 50 complaints of war crimes and other atrocities, and he never prosecuted any of them. And in fact, the German government was concerned that there was no prosecution under that statute, so they replaced the prosecutor. So we have a new prosecutor.
This 50 complaints against different individuals or against Rumsfeld? Or
this is a complaint that's against Rumsfeld and other high U.S. ranking officials. It's George Tenet, the former CIA.
Your complaint, the one that you're talking about now.
The current one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm getting mixed up here. I was asking if the 50 complaints that the previous prosecutor was ignoring were all against Rumsfeld, or was it just a wide array of complaints?
Oh, I see. No, the 50 earlier complaints were a wide array.
So basically, you had a prosecutor who wasn't interested in prosecuting human rights violations or war crimes.
That's exactly right.
And now you have a prosecutor who is willing to prosecute war crimes under German law that's pretty strong on this issue. The Germans certainly know about war crimes. And so they're taking your complaint against Rumsfeld, Tenet, et al. Seriously.
Yeah, well, we hope that they will. You know, this is, Tom, this is about justice and accountability. We represent and are putting forward 12 victims of abuse and torture at the hands of the Bush administration. 11 of them had been in Abu Ghraib, and one of them is currently in Guantanamo. In the ensuing period, there's been no justice for these folks. It's no doubt that they've been tortured, but they have not been able to have this aired and have their day in court. But it's also about accountability. It's about you hear a lot from the Bush administration that says we don't do torture and that kind of stuff, but they most certainly do. And this time we have additional evidence as to how that program developed, what that program is, and we're hoping that the German government will do something that the American government has not done, which is to look at them seriously, investigate them, and prosecute where prosecution is warranted.
Now, the International Court at The Hague, because it's a tribunal created by the United Nations, has, at least in theory, the power to reach out and seize people who are indicted and hold them and prosecute them. Under what authority would Germany reach out and seize Donald Rumsfeld and prosecute him, or would he be held in trial in absentia?
Well, the German statute is one in which the German government prosecutor can prosecute for war crimes, crimes of genocide, crimes against humanity that occur anywhere in the world, irrespective of the location of the defendant or plaintiffs, where the crime was carried out, where the nationalities of the persons involved. And as such, if they investigate and if they find that there have been war crimes that have been committed, and under the definition of war crimes, the idea of torture, inhuman, cruel, and inhumane treatment falls under war crimes. They can certainly take whatever steps that are necessary to certainly, if perpetrators come on German soil, that they should have jurisdiction over those folks.
So you end up with a situation like Pinochet faced when he was held criminally culpable for what he did in Chile by the British government, and he showed up in London and they arrested him.
That's correct.
And, so Donald Rumsfeld would put himself at risk if he showed up in Germany. Why not? First of all, two questions, actually. Number one, didn't somebody try something 10, 15 years ago, somebody try something like this against Henry Kissinger unsuccessfully in Germany? And number two, why not bring this charge against Rumsfeld at all before the International Criminal Court in The Hague instead of in Germany?
With respect to the first issue, it's not clear to me exactly what happened and why it was unsuccessful with Kissinger, but there's a very good reason why this is not before the International Criminal Court, and that is essentially because the U.S. Refused to sign on to being under the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court, and that's really precisely why it shows that the United States government is not serious about two things. One, investigating the perpetrations of crimes that it commits, and second, it doesn't seem to be intent on being a part of the world community. When the world community recognizes things that the Bush administration refuses to acknowledge, it refuses to submit itself to the inspection of the world community on these issues.
Right. Interesting. We're talking with Vince Warren. He's with the Center for Constitutional Rights. He's the executive director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, ccr-ny.org, the website. Vince, is this the sort of thing that is subject to public opinion? I mean, is this the sort of thing where we can contact our member of Congress and say, do something about this? Or is this the sort of thing that's simply going to happen in the German courts or not?
Well, this is going to happen in the German courts, but I think that U.S. public opinion is extremely important on this issue, and I'll tell you why. The elections, people have been talking a lot about what the elections mean, and from our perspective here at CCR, what the elections mean are that average U.S. citizens have taken a stand against the U.S. position in Iraq. And by electing the Democrats on primarily on that issue and on the failure of leadership there, I think it's beginning to be clear to the administration and the legislators that the Americans aren't going to sit down for what they consider failed or flawed policy. There is not a person in America, I think, who would truly condone the torture and severe inhumane treatment of prisoners on American soil by the American government, or even by the American government outside of American soil.
Oh, wait a second. You said there's not a person who would condone it. Here's Bill O'Reilly.
I don't give them any protection. I don't feel sorry for them. In fact, I probably would have ordered their execution if I had the power.
Talking about people in Guantanamo.
Well, but what I meant was not a person worth listening to.
I see. Okay.
And what we have here is this is a really a tremendous opportunity for your listeners, for other folks in the country to reach out to their senators and their legislators. Not necessarily we want all the support we can for this lawsuit, but there is something that Congress needs to do. Congress needs to do a number of things. Number one, we should be reaching out to the new congressional leaders to have them reverse the course that they'd taken with this horrible Military Commissions Act that was signed by the President on October 17th. That Military Commissions Act condones torture. It gives U.S. government officials essentially amnesty for committing human rights and torture abuses, and it strips the rights of the habeas rights of detainees in Guantanamo. The second thing we should be telling the legislature to do would be to seriously investigate some of the issues that we're bringing forward and that have been out there for a while. Donald Rumsfeld has been the architect of this program of torture. He has authorized
Rumsfeld and Cheney and Alberto Gonzalez
that's right. And
so basically, we're just out of time here, Vince. Basically, people can go to ccr-ny.org for more information on this, and they should contact their elected officials and say, please support the Center for Constitutional Rights in their efforts.
Absolutely.
Okay, that's a good start. And let's hold these guys accountable. We are not a nation of war criminals. We don't want to be represented as such. We don't want to be represented by such. Vince Warren, the Center for Constitutional Rights, ccr-ny.org. Check it out, the website. Thanks, Vince.
Thanks, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour. And welcome Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM, 440-8466. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. And apparently somebody was listening when Bill O'Reilly said,
So, all those clowns over at the liberal radio network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains?
Yeah. And I have here an internal email in Air America. This program syndicated by Air America. Late yesterday afternoon, a letter postmarked from September was opened by a show staff member that contained white powder. 9/11 was called, and various law enforcement agencies were here throughout the evening. Tests were performed on site, and results indicated it was not a harmful substance, et cetera. But, you know, white powder arrives. Thank you, Bill O'Reilly.
So, all those clowns over at the liberal radio network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains?
These guys just think this is so funny, you know? Yeah, let's all become Nazis. It's a tragedy. Todd in Kirkland, Washington. Hey, Todd, welcome to the program.
Hey, it's good to talk to you.
Thank you.
Here's the question, Tom. Can you help me out with this?
I'll do my best. Depends on the question.
All the media have been coming, counting noses, you know, Republicans versus Democrats to see
right.
who will control Congress.
Right.
And to that extent, doesn't that prove that the two-party system has taken over the government? I mean, to some extent, we have some degree of rubber stampism on both sides of the aisle.
Sure.
What do you think?
Well, we have a two-party system in the United States. You know, we are one of six nations in the world that basically is forced into a two-party system, a largely two-party system, by virtue of the way our Constitution is written. It's something the founders struggled with. They couldn't figure out a way to do it right. James Madison in 1787 in the Federalist Papers, Federalist Number 10, I mean, go read it. It's only about a page and a half long. He talks about how they couldn't figure out how to do, you know, if basically he called them factions back then. They referred to political parties as factions. And he said if factions emerge, if political parties emerge, and there's more than two of them, you're going to have an undemocratic outcome from elections. You could have somebody elected, if there was three factions, you could have somebody elected who only represents 34% of the people. If there was four factions, somebody only represents 26% of the people. And they couldn't figure out how to do this. It wasn't until 1861, you know, long after the framers were dead, that John Stuart Mill came up with the idea of proportional representation, where if a party gets 22% of the vote and there's 100 seats in Parliament, they get 22 seats. If they get 41% of the vote, they get 41 seats. And they're, you know, with that system, you can have 5, 6, 7, 8, 10, 12. You can have as many political parties as you want. As long as somebody can get 1% of the vote, they can have a seat in Parliament or in Congress. But the United States and Greece have pure winner-take-all first past the post elections, and Canada and England have a modification of halfway us and halfway proportional representation, so they have two strong political parties. And New Zealand and Australia have a system like ours, and they solved the problem with instant runoff voting. So when you say we have a two-party system that's taken over Congress, yes, and it's been that way since the country was founded, and the only way to solve the problem at the federal level would either be to amend the Constitution and go to proportional representation, which I think would be a bad idea, because you start amending the Constitution, you open a huge can of worms, or do national instant runoff voting, which I'm a strong proponent of.
Well, in my opinion, I'm aware of some of those issues, and I should read more, but I think where we need to go is towards disaggregating the choices on a lot of different issues, instead of having them all aggregated not only into one representative who then goes and supposedly represents us on all issues, but having them aggregated into one party, which is just, or two parties, basically. That aggregates them excessively and removes our choice over individual issues.
I don't disagree. And like I said, that's what Madison was struggling with. But he couldn't come up with a solution. And I think we have one now in instant runoff voting, which over 300 communities now across the United States have adopted very successfully. And the Green Party has been the largest advocate of. They've been, you know, responsible for this happening in most places because, you know, it helps them out. And frankly, both the Democratic and Republican parties generally oppose instant runoff voting because it's a challenge to their power. But I think it's a good thing. And that's right now, the way that our Constitution is set up, and it's not going to be changed any day soon, I can guarantee you, Todd, that's the way to do what you want to do. If you want to disaggregate that power, you do it by putting forward instant runoff voting. Todd, I appreciate the call. Good to hear from you. Donald in Anacortes, Washington. Hey, Donald, we've got about a minute before we've got to take a break. What's up?
Yeah, well, I heard you talking earlier today about the budget deficit.
Yeah. And you quoted figures from the Wall Street Journal.
Right.
And I've seen similar figures from the New York Times, and they're all wrong. If you go to www.publicdebt.trez.gov, you will get, I think, should be the real figures. They're the government figures. Shows the total deficit in October of this year was $77.3 billion.
Right.
The deficit in November so far, first 10 days of November, is $19.4 billion.
Right. Now, let me stop you right there, Donald. The reason why the real number is $77 billion and the Wall Street Journal is reporting $44 billion is because the Treasury Department is reporting the off-budget expenditures for the war in Iraq, which this year is almost $100 billion, and the administration is not.
And, the deficit for 2006 was $574 billion.
Yeah, yeah. Again, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And thanks for pointing that out. Oh yeah, I'm sorry. We got to wrap up the hour or the half hour here. 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with your calls and more right after this.
Show a little passion, baby. Show a little style.
Welcome back to the radio support group up by and for We the People of the United States of America, the Tom Hartman program, 34 minutes past the hour. David, did I play the Eisenhower campaign commercial when I was doing my Eisenhower clips earlier? I don't think I did I?
I don't think so.
Yeah, okay. Then I'm going to get to your phone calls here. I played some clips earlier from Dwight Eisenhower speaking at the 1964 Republican Convention about how important it is that America behave decently at home and abroad. This is from his campaign when he ran for president in 1952. This is Dwight Eisenhower's campaign commercial. Notice how a Republican was running for president.
Eisenhower knows how to deal with the Russians.
He knows how to deal with the Russians.
Has met Europe's leaders.
He's met Europe's leaders.
Has got them working with us.
Has got them working with us. Whoa, what a concept.
Elect the number one man for the number one job of our time. November 4th, vote for peace.
Vote for peace? November 4th, vote for peace?
Vote for Eisenhower. A paid film.
Isn't that incredible? Now, here's the whole thing, just straight through.
Eisenhower knows how to deal with the Russians. He has met Europe's leaders, has got them working with us. Elect the number one man for the number one job of our time. November 4th, vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower. A paid film.
Vote for peace. Nowadays, it's Dennis Kucinich who's running those ads. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. John in San Francisco. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Yes, I voted for the Democrats after holding my nose, and I hoped that it would be a protest against Bush. But I think on second thought, I should have voted for my real choice, which would have been a left party like Workers Org or WSWS.org, because I think we're in much greater danger now in a bipartisan support for this war. And for not repealing the Military Commissions Act, the Patriot Act, all the things that the Democrats are really in a large part complicit in. And I see a real danger here that people will switch to what the Republicans were doing. I voted for the Republicans. As Republicans do, my ego is involved in this, so I will support them and make excuses to the bitter end. And I think Democrats may take up that same position as the Democrats show their complicity with maybe a quibbling over tactics in Iraq, over whether we should redeploy and kill more Iraqis from air rather than from the ground, reduce the number of American casualties, bribe and try to corrupt the American anti-war movement into neutrality on this whole thing. And I see a real danger here because the Democrats, like Hillary Clinton, the co-chair of the Democrat Leadership Party, council has called for more troops, not less troops. They're talking about victory, the same kinds of rhetoric that Bush is using, criticizing.
Yeah, John, take a breath for a second. I don't disagree with you. I think that we have, and in a vacuum, probably this, what you're describing is exactly what will happen or what could happen. And that is that the Democrats will just go down the road along with the Republicans because you've got the military-industrial complex. You've got enormous amounts of money being made on this war, mind-boggling amounts of money. And a lot of that money is funneled back to Washington, D.C. and is financing into the Democrats as well as the Republicans. You're absolutely right. And frankly, if the CPUSA was in power, they'd be funneling money back to them. I mean, you know, ultimately, this is the problem, John, is as long as we think that it's about the party or it's about the candidate, we're screwed. It's about us. When enough of us speak out and say, we are going to be heard, we are not going away, we are going to be active, you are not our leaders, you are our representatives. When we say that to our elected officials, because we don't elect leaders in the United States, you will not find the word leader anywhere in the Constitution. We elect representatives to represent us. And if in the absence of our speaking out, you're absolutely right that that's the danger. But frankly, even the Green Party could be corrupted. And in fact, has been in some cases, you know, where they're taking money from Republicans.
Yeah, what I'm saying, though, is that we got to think for ourselves, as you're saying, because the Democrats and the Republicans, once they join hands and then quibble only over small tactics, this could be an even more dangerous thing because people say, well, who am I, little old me, to say that I should continue to call for immediate withdrawal,
withdrawal? I get it. And what you're suggesting is that we should go to a third party or something like that. And what I'm suggesting is something even more radical than that, John. I'm way more radical than let's go with a third party. What I'm suggesting is that folks like you and I, folks who understand what has happened in the United States and understand the direction that we need to go, that we infiltrate and take over the Democratic Party.
Well, I don't know whether that's possible, but I think we got to be on guard.
I think it's our only option.
Well, I think, though, that we've got to be on guard against the idea that we should be we can be co-opted as well by the Democratic leadership and even Air America. What in the world is this jerk, Glenn Beck, gobbling up all kinds of airtime, infiltrating Air America? It's like they'll take money from anybody.
We're capitalists. You know, what can I say? I understand.
This is vicious stuff that he peddles. I mean, he outdoes sponsors.
And here you and I are talking about it.
Yeah.
We can talk about it all day long. I mean, he can advertise all day long.
But I'm saying that people, general public listening to that, who aren't clued in, this is an implicit endorsement of his fascist ravings for war and imperialism around the world and scaremongering beyond anything even Bush would do. They're trying to
the minute you begin censoring your advertisers because of their political content, you go down a real dangerous road.
Well, I'm just saying, have a caveat in there. Constantly expose who this guy is.
The caveat on all commercial radio, and for that matter, even on public radio, which is frankly becoming
CIA.
Just another business. No, the caveat is that, you know, the source of revenue and the source of editorial content are different. You know, that money comes into the organization and keeps it going, thank God. And, you know, that's a fine thing. And what that money's about and what the editorial content, what I'm saying, what you and I are saying right now, are different things. And I think most people can separate that.
I think the general listener can't.
I think they can. I'm willing to give my listeners more credit for intelligence than that. I really am, John. And you know, you illustrate that. I mean, you got it. You got it right away. I think the average person gets it. That what we're about is something very different from what Glenn Beck is about. John, I got to move along. I appreciate the call, though, and thanks for listening to us on the Quake there. Steven in Danville, California. Hey, Steven.
Hey, Tom. I met you at the Pioneers Conference.
Oh, great. Great.
I was one of the infiltrators running for Congress, trying to grab the Democratic Party by the lapels and shake them into some sense.
And good on you, Stephen, for doing it. And that's what it's going to take. It's going to take us showing up. And see, it's not just enough to vote for the Democratic Party. It really requires us to show up at the county meetings and say, I'm here. I'm going to be a part of this. I'm going to have a say in how this is done because it starts at the county level, or in some cases the precinct level, and you know, take back the party. The conservatives began infiltrating the Republican Party in the late 1950s, early 1960s. They were horrified that Eisenhower was such a liberal, and they wanted to swing the Republican Party hard to the right. They had a momentary success in 1964 with Barry Goldwater, and then the party kind of went back into the middle. And they just started working really, really hard in the early 1970s. And boom, they got Reagan elected in 1980. Yep. We need to be doing the same thing with the Democratic Party, just like progressives and populists did in the period from around 1912 to around 1932, infiltrating the Democratic Party and becoming part of the Democratic Party so that they were ready when the election of 32 came and they got Roosevelt in on a very modest platform, by the way. You should know, Roosevelt's platform in 1932 was very much like Hillary Clinton's platform right now. He was running as a moderate, and he was saying, we're not going to go communist, we're not going to go fascist, because those were like the options that everybody was talking about. And he was running as a, let's go down the middle moderate, and the people spoke. The people said, no, we want radical change. We don't want to go communist or fascist, but we want radical change. And that's what Roosevelt brought. And it's because of the people. And that's, we have to get out there and get involved. And good on you for doing it, Stephen.
Well, I'm now a member of the Democratic Central Committee, an alternate at least. And I ran as an FDR Democrat, meaning the New Deal, and that resonated with a lot of people, and I may be running for state assembly.
Good on you. That's great. That's
great. We got to take it back.
I agree. But that's not what you called about.
No, well, I got a couple of things here, and we can start with James Baker. This guy has so many conflicts of interest. Sending him over there to make this piece is literally like sending the fox in to make sure the hen house stays standing long enough for him to bag up all the chickens.
Well, keep in mind, James Baker is representing the interests of Bush Sr., both the interest of maintaining or saving the reputation of the Bush dynasty, number one, and number two, maintaining and saving the billions of dollars that the Bushes have succeeded in transferring from Middle Eastern oil interests to their business holdings.
Right.
And business holdings associated with them, principally the Carl Al Group, over the last 30 years. But, I mean, going all the way back to Prescott Bush, really,
right, when
he was doing business with Hitler. James Baker is the consigliere for the Bush family. So he's first and foremost representing the Bush family. Secondly, to the extent that the Bush family is based in the United States, he's representing the United States. And I think probably most people get that. And the problem is that out of George W. Bush, you think you're going to get much better?
No.
See, I mean, that's why, again, we need guys like you, Stephen, involved in politics, out there doing the steps, getting involved and working your way up through the political system so that the next election, we're looking at some really good candidates, some really solid people who really get it and can participate in government in a real and meaningful way inside, in my opinion, the Democratic Party. And frankly, I think the Republican Party as well. I would like to see people who, like my father was before he died a few months ago, an Eisenhower Republican, taking back the Republican Party. Let's bring America back to America. 45 minutes past the hour. The pill that will help you escape the matrix, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Our telephone number, 866-440-THOM, 440-8466. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to tomhartman.com and just click live chat. It's free and it's fun, and some of the finest minds on the entire internet hanging out there every day. Grace in Napa, California on the line. Hey, Grace, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom, for taking my call. I believe that the progressives should be civil, but I don't believe that they should patronize this fascist administration. And I have an analogy. It's a story I heard years ago. I'm 73. There was a fire that ravaged the mountainside, and it left a charred. And the man was coming down the mountain, and he met up with a snake. The snake begged the man to pick him up and take him down to the bottom of the mountain. The man said, no, you're a snake. You'll bite me. He said, he promised the man that he wouldn't bite him. So he picked up the snake and he took him down. When he got to the bottom, the snake whipped the ground and bit him. And he said, you promised not to bite me. He said, well, you knew I was a snake when you picked me up.
Yeah. I've heard variations on that. There's an old Buddhist one about a man and a tiger. But yeah, it's the nature of the beast. In other words, we should learn from experience. We should look at the way Republicans have behaved or Democrats should look at the way the Republicans have behaved and say, no, we're not going to make nice to.
I don't understand why Barbara Bush is calling Bill Clinton, and seemed to be quite friendly, calling him son.
Well, because the Clinton dynasty is merging with the Bush dynasty, in my opinion. Bill Clinton, you know, grew up dirt poor, and now he's got, I think he's very flattered by the attention of billionaires, of basically America's royalty. The Bush family and the Kennedy family were the big competitors to be America's royalty throughout the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and now the Bushes have won, essentially, and Clinton is like, I think, just in awe of them.
Yeah, I feel the same way.
And I think it's a shame. I think that they're going to use him and spit him out. On the other hand, they'll make him rich in the process, so he's probably not going to feel too badly spit out. But and odds are that they're going to, say Domini, you're all Catholic now to his wife, and help make her president. I mean, it's entirely possible. And once again, it gets back to, if we the people don't wake up and start participating in this political process, we're just going to watch this thing slide by. And also, that's to say, for example, if Hillary Clinton was on the ticket, if the election was tomorrow, and Hillary Clinton was running against any Republican, as much as I dislike many of the positions that Hillary Clinton has taken, I would vote for her because it's, number one, she's not a Republican, and number two, because I continue to believe, because I've seen this, you look at the 230-year arc of American history, you see this over and over and over again. It is not the politician. It is not the person. It's the parade. It's about we the people getting loud enough and assertive enough and out there enough and involved enough that our politicians are forced to essentially change their tunes.
Yeah, it really amounts to people power.
Yeah, that's really what it is. It's, Margaret Mead, it's become a hackneyed cliche that is on, posters in, on people's walls. Never doubt that a small group of committed people can't change the world. Indeed, that's the only way it's ever happened. But it's true, and that's us. And we need to keep on speaking out, and Grace, I congratulate you for speaking out, and thank you very much for calling the program.
Well, thank you, Tom, for all you're doing for us, the people,
you're
the
welcome.
United States.
There you go. That's us. Thank you, Grace. Good talking with you today. Jim in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jim, welcome to the program.
Thank you, sir, and I really appreciate all the hard work you and your staff do.
Well, thank you. Thank you for listening to us on WPTT there in Pittsburgh.
Thank you. The reason I called is that the Senate violated the Constitution just before they left to go back and run for office. On September 30th at 1:06 a.m. in the morning, they passed a new UK-US extradition treaty. Now, we won't go into all that, but the treaty requires two-thirds of the Senate in order to move on. And at that time, 1:06 a.m. on September 30th, there was only a couple of senators in residence, maybe less than five, we're not sure. But they passed this on a division vote. They had this connected to another thing. And there was no roll call. They just said, how many people are for it, stand up. And so we don't know who the senators were that were there. And we do know that it wasn't two-thirds of the Senate. And this was violating the Constitution of the United States. So regardless of your opinion about the treaty, treaties are extremely important, and especially these new treaties and this one that violates our Constitution.
Yeah, let me point out, Jim, that for our listeners who don't know, that treaties actually supersede all laws in the land except the Constitution. They're essentially amendments to the Constitution. And the Constitution says that treaties are part of the law of the land. And that's why it requires a two-thirds vote to ratify a treaty. And the extradition treaty with the UK essentially gives the police in the United Kingdom the power to come to the United States and arrest Americans.
We won't go into the details. But the point is that this happened, on September 30th, and we're hoping to try to find a way to reverse it.
Who's we?
Well, Irish American community and the ACLU.
Oh, great. So the ACLU is on this.
We went after Santorum, Chafee, Allen, and DeWine, and they all lost. Now, we didn't do it by ourselves, but we certainly had our two cents in there. And here in Western Pennsylvania, we fought like the devil to get Santorum defeated, and that was our contribution. But it's not enough. We've got to find out how this happened, why it happened, and to prevent it from happening again.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to know that the ACLU is on it, Jim. I didn't know that. I haven't been keeping up with their website recently, even though I'm a card-carrying member.
Thank you for that. Thanks for your show.
Sure enough. Thank you, Jim, for the call. And keep us up to date on that thing. I'll start following it more. I didn't realize that it had passed the Senate. That's occasionally something slides by me. I'll be the first to admit. Coming up tomorrow, I'll be challenging conservative Brent Bozell about whether or not Keith Olbermann is preaching hate speech, and Fidel Castro's handbook. George Galloway will be here. That and more in your calls. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.